K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Mindful Mud. I'm Florina Nickley, your host. I'm a Zen teacher and mindfulness instructor. This show is about mindfulness and all the different ways that we can implement it in our lives. And I'm so excited today for my guest, who's calling in from Hawaii, Naoko Muller. She is a local, actually. You're living here, right, Naoko? Welcome, Naoko.
Thank you for having me.
Perhaps I'm going to say a couple things about you, just a little bit your bio, for people to kind of get interested in sticking around to the show. So Naoko Muller is a food activist, Japanese cooking connoisseur, and ESL educator. She is born in a Zen Buddhist temple in Niigata, Japan, raised in Hawaii and in Japan at Zen Buddhist temples. She learned how to cook by assisting her mother from an early age, and as a minister's wife by cooking for large groups at Zen Buddhist temples. She conducts Zen Buddhist vegetarian cooking workshops and educational workshops for parents and teachers in England, America, and in Japan, and lately in Italy, if I can say that. She operated an English school in Japan for over 20 years and worked also as a teacher trainer while managing the temple. She moved to Hawaii and taught Japanese language and Japanese culture at Honolulu Waldorf School. So currently, as I said, she is a local. She normally lives off the grid like a lot of us do here in this area, North California. Okay, so we are going to talk about mindful eating and mindful cooking and wherever else we're going to end up with your very interesting background, Naoko. But it's kind of like interesting right now to talk about cooking and eating during these holidays too. A lot of people are cooking a lot, are eating a lot too. And perhaps just kind of showing a different way of relating to how to cook and how to be with cooking. All right. So let's jump in. What's on your mind, Naoko?
Hi everyone. As all of us, you know, in our upbringing, we do things so naturally without any intentions. You think everyone knows what you're doing. And so my cooking experience really shifted when I moved to California, Garverville. And how it changed. How it changed was that, because as you know, in Hawaii, where I grew up, at one point after the war, 50% of the population was Japanese. So we have very, very deep connection to Japan. And so I grew up there and then married to, you know, Jay Mahler and moved to off the grid. I will cook something for him. And then one day he asked me, oh, so how do you eat this white rice? I serve him white rice in a bowl. And I said, well, it was a Japanese lunch. So there was a rice bowl, miso soup bowl, and several other dishes, not on one plate now. And so he asked me, how do you eat this white rice? And I'm going, what are you talking about? And so I said, okay, so what you do is you get one bite of white rice in your mouth, and then you put one spoonful of side dish in your mouth, and then you chew it, you blend the white rice and the side dish in your mouth, and then you will be able to enjoy another different harmony. And he couldn't do it. And I go, no, he said, why can't I put this on the rice? I said, that's a no-no. I grew up, as my mother or my father would say, don't dirty the rice.
Oh.
That is because rice is very important to our Japanese culture. And at one point, rice was a currency. And by counting how many bags of rice you have in your storage, that was a sign of the wealth, how wealthy your family is. And rice is staple food. And we grew up, especially I come from the rice country in Japan. I grew up, and my mother used to say, there are seven gods on a grain of rice. You never ever leave even a grain of rice in the rice bowl. Because, and then also, rice bowl is considered to be Buddha's ashes. And so, of course, you don't want a dirty Buddha's ashes, right? And you have to respect that. And in a Japanese plate of food, the rice will be placed on the left-hand corner, left-hand front. That's the very place that's very closest to your heart.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were taught not to dirty the rice, so you never put things on the rice and mix it up. But that Japanese is the only culture do that. The other Asian countries, including Thai, Vietnamese, or Hindus, they mix everything on the plate or in the bowl. And that's how my husband was used to do eating.
Right.
So, but in Japanese, you can't do that. And then I noticed when I did cooking classes in California, people just couldn't eat the white rice. So the white rice would be left in a bowl. And so I figured, okay, that's why the foreigners cannot eat white rice as it is, because they don't know how to blend it in. We call it mouth in the mouth cooking or something. There's a third different level of enjoying it, you know. And so that's when I teach cooking, I began to flavor my rice prior to the meal instead of serving white rice.
Has that only happened since you lived here in California?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's so interesting to me that everything has a very deep meaning, right?
Yes, yeah.
Everything has a very deep meaning. And I would say when we eat here, most of in this Western, especially in the US, it's very random.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And a lot of people just don't even sit down anymore to eat, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Or eat in front of the TV, or it's just there is not much value put into really cooking and eating.
Yeah. So that was one thing, and then so I have all these rules that I tell my husband, oh, don't do that, don't do that. You should do this, and he goes, you in your rules, you know. And then I noticed, and then I said, of course, when I'm kind of, you know, I'm emotionally stable, then I will go into explaining everything. But when I'm kind of irritated, and he asks me, okay, so how do you eat this? And I go, well, you don't put soy sauce on this and soy sauce on that. And then he said, and then he will go keep on asking me. I said, well, you just have to do what I said to do. That, you know, you just have to follow the rules. And then he would keep on asking me, and I said, yeah. So I said, well, all these rules, how do you know, or something like that? And I said, well, because my mother said, I mean, that was the end of the story. I said, because my mother said, that's how you're supposed to eat it.
Right.
But of course, yeah. But, you know, after I began teaching, or after my husband's comments, I started to kind of dig in and go, why? And then there were answers for everything. And so that part, we take it for granted. We don't even know, but we do it anyway. You know, so.
Oh, you didn't get raised with understanding the
exactly.
deeper
meaning.
Oh, I see. So you actually learned that later.
Yeah. So isn't it like, I don't know about other cultures, but Japanese Buddhist chanting, we don't know the meaning. So these days in the States, there is an English version of sutra chanting.
Right.
I can understand that, but the original one, I can recite many, many different sutras. I don't know the meaning. That's right. Not the point, but it's by reciting, it kind of goes into, but actually, that's not true, right?
Well, it's both. I mean, when it comes to sutra, my experience, you know, it's both because I used to also recite some sutras in Japanese, right? And I kind of liked it almost better than, like, for me growing up in and studying Zen in Europe, it was German, the translation, which was fine. But as soon as you know the words, your mind starts to get kicked in.
Ah, that's true.
And so if I was reciting them in Japanese, it was more that singing and really being with, you know, with the rest of the 100 people in the Sendo and really chanting and becoming really one and in the moment with that activity of being with it, instead of the mind is thinking, oh, it says like this and I should be doing this. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so the chanting itself is not really Japanese, right? So then as a child, of course we recite, and the reciting, it's I guess that's where the meaning comes in. So you don't really have to know the meaning, but you just have to do it the way they tell you to do it, you know. So that's that, so the life was like that, especially in temple. So I was born in this Zen temple in the snow country, northwestern Tokyo. And the temple itself, this October, just celebrated 500 years.
Wow.
But the main Buddha in the the main altar, so long ago, all the temples used to be up in the mountains. So the previous building was up in the mountains. So the Buddha itself is about 1,000 years old. So it came down to where it is now 500 years ago. And part of the building that sits there is about 500 years old. And so I was born, actually, I had a room there. I was actually born in that room. So that, you know, if you have 500 years old building, it's so cold in the winter.
Yes.
Like when you wake up in the morning, there's a like mount of snow on my desk.
Oh, wow.
Because the temple is, of course, Japanese buildings are wooden. And so in winter, it kind of soaks up the moisture. And so the top of the window is shut tight, but the bottom, there's like opening is separate.
Oh, I see. Open. Yeah.
That's where you got snow comes in. Anyway, so that's the kind of temple that I was born. I grew up. My father in that temple was the 27th generation. And before Soto Zen.
Perhaps
you're
going to let the listeners know what that means, the 27th generation.
So yeah, before it became Soto Zen temple, it used to be, was different Buddhist sect. And then, so about 500 years ago, my Zen monk, when they opened the temple, they changed it into Zen sect. So especially in Zen sect, it's not hereditary. I mean, it's not, my father is not a the heir, but my father was adopted. So there are some people missing in between, but he is a 27th generation of as a main monk of that temple.
All right.
And so my brother is actually 28th generation, but currently he is here in Honolulu and he is the bishop of Soto Zen temple here.
Yes, because you're calling in from Hawaii right now.
Yes.
From another temple.
Yes. Yes, Hawaii, as you know, it's we have a lot of Japanese immigrants, of course, Asian. First came the Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and went on and on. But in the late 1800s, the first Japanese came to Hawaii to work in a sugar plantation. And when the Japanese were not, they were missionaries too, but we don't consider Japanese ministers missionaries because they were already Buddhist. And so the first immigrants, first foreigner was, white people, you know, from the East Coast came into to Hawaii. And So those are the first people that came. Those are the missionaries. But when the Japanese immigrants came, the Japanese government figured that they need to have a temple, because temple was served as a center of the community, you know, serving. So the temple monks used to be teachers. Temple monks used to have a role of counselors. It was like a center of the community. So the plantation agreed to build the temple in the plantation community. So in Hawaii, sugar plantation everywhere in the state of Hawaii. So there were a lot of different temples. And my grandfather was one of the young monks that was sent from the Japanese government to care for the immigrants.
I see.
Yes.
And so you grew up in Japan at that mm-hmm. old temple.
Yeah.
And then you moved to Hawaii. When did you get started yes. with cooking? Like, when did you get interested in cooking?
So my grandfather, after that, my father took over. But my father was going back and forth from Japan to Hawaii. And in Japan, we usually serve food after memorial services or special occasions, you know, things like that, in the temple. And so because it was a pretty big monastery type temple, we actually, in the summer special occasions, we had about 200 people actually staying over. It was served like, what do you call those? You know, people come to, when they come to the temple to have it blessed or to do some kind of training session, they will stay over, and that's when we feed them.
Right.
Yeah.
Like some so, kind of, okay.
Retreat, you know, like some kind of
a retreat. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's when my mother have to ask people to help. And there's, in olden days, there are certain families that actually belong to the temple who are the assistants of the temple. So every time when there's a special occasion, this certain family, one or two person from a certain family will come and work in the temple. So right now, you know, when I was little, one of the family, old grandpa used to come. If the grandpa passes, then the father will come and help, you know, even if they're working in a regular community, they still have to take time off to come and help the temple.
Right. It's part of what you do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And so my mother would, you know, gather everything, and we will prepare the Zen food. And it's usually Zen food. It's vegetarian, actually vegan. Of course, vegan is not Zen food, but Zen food is vegan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And so we will serve them in individual dishes. And that's when my mother always used to say, you know, it's all going to be for you, you know, so you have to help. And not just help, but we have to, because we are the daughters of the monks. So we had to, if my mother was not there for some odd reason, we had to gather the workers and tell them what to do. So we had a special position. Mm-hmm. And so my mother's, so of course, as a child, I will help them chop and stuff like that. But after high school, I will be right behind my mother, and my mother say, okay, this is, what do you think you need to add? So she would actually you know, teach us by doing. And it's not just about the taste, but of course, in Zen cooking, the presentation is very important. And seasonal, you know, make sure to add seasonal things and presentation. And so that was very important. And so I learned all that. So I have never been to a cooking school, anything like that. But
well, that is a cooking school right there.
Yeah.
And again, the cultures are so different, right? In Japan.
Right.
Right. It's a different thing. You learn, and especially mm-hmm. when you grow up in a temple, just learning from your mother.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, eventually when my father came to Hawaii, we moved to Hawaii. But in the, let's see, in 1970s, I was in Hawaii. The temple was still like a center of the Japanese community. So members will come, the ladies will, every time when the members will come to do some work, like outside work or maintaining the temple, the wives will get together and they cook at the temple, and that still continue to, you know, to this day.
And what would you say when you say, you know, growing up, learning how to cook like that, you obviously didn't learn how to cook mindful, like you didn't learn how to cook first and then learn on top of that how to cook mindfully. You just learned how to cook mindfully in a sense.
Well, because it's not just learning how to cook. We had young monks living in monks with us. So my father was pretty strict. We had 7 o'clock breakfast, 10 o'clock tea, 12 o'clock lunch, 3 o'clock tea. Of course, summer and winter is different, but 6 o'clock dinner. And then, you know, the seatings were already set, and then we will all sit, and then my father will come, and then we'll just put our hands together. We start eating. We cannot stand up unless my father is gone. And of course, and there is a way to cook, I mean eat. So it's not all about cooking, but it's about how to, you know, partake the food. And of course, if there's offering in the altar, we will get that and make sure we eat that too. And so it's not, and then of course in the morning before I go to school, I had my section where I had to do cleaning, right? Where
oh,
the
so
young monk.
Before school, you even cooked and cleaned and did all the rituals. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the young monks. So our house, our temple is pretty big from one end to the other. Anyway, the monks, my father would, they would be all chanting sutras going around the whole temple every morning, you know. And then after that, they will have breakfast. And of course, there is a, before, like taking a bath, in the bath where you undress yourself, there's a little Buddha and there's a short sutra you have to chant. I mean, there's Buddha everywhere. You have to chant everywhere. And of course, as a child, I learned how to kind of shortcut everything, you know, but still, if my father is there, we have to go through the whole thing. And all these things, it's a daily thing, and then you just learn by heart, right?
You just do it because it's part of what you do. Yeah.
No. You just do it because my father said to do it.
Oh, that's how it goes. I see. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, like I said, I don't know the meaning until recently. You start kind of. Oh, the first thing was when I went to California, like my husband's friends will come, and then my husband will go, oh, this is not Naoko, he grew up in a Zen temple and blah, blah, blah. And the first question I get is, so do you practice Zen every day? And I'm like, what? Nobody asked me that kind of question in Hawaii or in Japan. And then I kind of knew it how to answer by saying, well, Zen is not about practice. It's what, from the time you wake up to from the time you go to sleep, the whole daily routine is a practice. And there's, so I don't really practice. So Zen, we do what we call the silent meditation. So actually that and meditation is a little bit different. But then in English, we say, yeah, silent meditation. But Zen practice is not all about silent meditation. It's
that's right. It's everything.
Action. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, then, you know, you have the zazen where you do sit quietly. And it is funny because I think it's just a difference. You grow up in a Zen temple.
Yeah, yeah.
Being immersed 24/7 in practice, not even like, why would anybody ask? This would be like somebody ask, are you breathing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And for us, like for me, for instance, for me growing up, yes, I had to learn how to practice Zen, right, in that way of like slowing everything down, like really starting to become like asking those questions of meaningfulness and slowing my life down to start to be more immersed in that present moment experience, and so it's a totally different way of approaching it, right?
Yes, totally different. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very fascinating.
Yeah. And then here in Hawaii too, we have, although we don't live in the same building, there's several ministers with their family, right? And then every morning at six o'clock in the morning, there's a morning service. Of course, we had to do that. And Sunday morning, we had Zazen, the silent meditation. We had to do that, you know. Yeah, it's just so different. But so that's that. But now when I cook, I like to, especially in the morning when everything is quiet, or when things are like in a chaos, say there's like 10 people in the kitchen trying to figure something out. But when I'm standing in front of, I mean, with my cutting board and knife, when I start chopping something, there are moments that unintentionally, I'm not actually slowing down. I'm doing it really quickly, but my mind is slow. My mind slows down, and I see myself from up around here, you know, over my head. I'm looking down, and so I think that never really happened when I was young, but that's what the same experience as you get from like the silent meditation, or where you feel the emptiness, you know, it just makes it so comfortable to be embraced in that emptiness. Even the surrounding is like a chaos. And then at that moment, there were several occasions, the students that was acting in the kitchen or even over Zoom, they would say, oh, Naoko-san, why can you be so calm when your people are in chaos? But I don't do it intentionally. So that's kind of cool that when I felt that I could feel there's empty space in my whole being, I guess people around me will actually notice that my hands are moving really quickly, but as a whole being, I'm very calm, and, you know, I just do what I have to do, really in focusing.
So you're centered. Your mind is where your knife is, right? Yeah. Your mind is where your knife is, and your smell is where, you know, that smell comes from the food. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is really, for me, cooking is one of those things that it doesn't matter how busy my day was, I always have energy left to cook because it gets me in such a good centered mood. And I can, it's so creative, and it's something I can really deeply practice and come to a very centered place. Even if I like multitask, you know, have like three dishes going at the same time, I'm still getting really centered in that. It's such a miraculous thing to do for me. And I feel sometimes so sad when I know how many people don't even cook anymore, you know?
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. I don't know. My life would be miserable. Yeah. Yeah. And you just grew up with it no matter what, right?
Yeah. And then, but recently I experienced something totally different. So on the way to Hawaii, we usually spend time at my husband's brother's place. He's a vineyard and winery, and they had one weekend they had grape picking. Volunteers came to pick grapes. And so my sister-in-law would prepare lunch. And so she had asked me to chop up a salad. And she said, oh, yeah, there's 45 minutes, so there's lots of time. And it was like five cabbage. And I go, wow. And then she brought this food processor. And she said, yeah, just, you know, put it in here, and then you kind of push it in, and it will shred everything for you. So that's how I made the salad. But that was a totally different experience. And well, this is not cooking. I was like making the feed for the animals. I mean, you know, all you do is you will chop up with a certain size, and you kind of push it into the food processor and just go, right? And here you have the same thing, but for me, there's no time to put my hard in it. I just had to focus, make sure, because she didn't bring the thing to push it down, so I was using my hand. I had to just really concentrate. I don't slice my finger.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you're so used to use the knife for
yes,
everything.
Yeah, yeah. And so I said, wow, this is just not, I don't really feel good doing this. So the outcome is the same, looks the same. But so this is not, it's for me, it was not really the whole process. It was not mindful at all. And so I really think that cooking, mindful cooking means you really have to, all the little procedures are very, very important to me. It doesn't, of course, in Zen cooking, we have what we call the three hearts in cooking. And so Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, wrote, it is said to be the first instruction book written for the cooks. And so in it, it's not a recipe book. It just teaches us the attitude towards food. And in that, he concludes this whole book by saying there's three hearts. And the first one is called Kishin, which means joyful heart. So you have to prepare with joy. You know, you think about who you are going to prepare for, and you always have to feel joyful. So that food processor experience was not joyful.
Yes.
It was scary, actually.
It was stressful.
Yeah. And then another one is roshing, which means, you know, have a heart like how your grandfather, grandparents or your parents foster your child.
Okay.
That means if you are cooking, like that's what I always tell my students, make sure you prepare the dishes. Because if your dishes is like 5 inches, and if you cut the vegetables 7 inches, it's going to stick out. That's not right. Or if you're serving the food to your grandparents, you want to make it, you know, less salty or cook a little bit more so that there is tender enough. So make sure you think about who you are cooking for. And of course, at the same time, you have to make sure you know what you're using, what kind of ingredients you're using. If you are using something green, you want to enhance the green color. So you have to be prepared to cook it at the right way, right time, you know, so to keep the nice, right texture.
So it's about the texture and the color and the shape.
Yes. And then the last one is Taishin, which means with big heart. That means without any discrimination. So even you pick the weed, even you buy crooked, you know, half rotten vegetables, you have to treat them. Even you buy these organic or non-organic, everything, you have to make sure the way you handle it is the same, without any discriminations. And of course, who you are serving to, you know, make sure you use it in a way that it's supposed appropriately with gratitude and with appreciation, handle the vegetables in the right way. Yeah. So those are the three things. And it's actually simple, but yeah, it really helps, because I did a session yesterday, and it's all about, it's not just about how to cook, but it's about what to use too. So it's not, you people, we nowadays, you see, you hear the word, they say we are what we eat, right?
Yes.
But I said it's we are how we eat, you know. So it's not just you don't eat it for the sake of eating it, but you have to make sure to prepare it in a way that everyone can enjoy adjusting it. So in Japanese cooking, which is this Zen, the book, cook for the what do you call that, instruction for the cook, Kendo kyoku. That's the basis of all Japanese cuisine. And we don't really have the word recipe in Japanese.
Oh,
Because
really?
that's like being imported. Everything
So,
by your hand, you know.
yes, it's not like so many cups of this and then
No.
so many grand, yeah.
Yeah,
But it's
yeah.
more like it comes out of your knowledge and how
Yes,
it's
yes.
handed down.
And so if you would look closely to the ingredients that's in front of you, you'll know how much to, you know, for example, if you have very seasonal greens, it won't take long to cook. But if you buy something old from the market, it might take a little longer to cook. So you just have, it doesn't really go by minutes. You just have to know it. That's practice.
Yeah, and it's about paying attention, right? Again, I
Exactly,
didn't
paying
know.
attention.
So those three hearts go all the way back to Dogen, huh?
Yes,
Yeah.
Dogen, yes.
That's amazing.
1200,
That
yes.
makes me, yeah, I mean, that's what an intention right there. And then also it's like I could imagine, I was visualizing myself to cook like this right then when you shared this. And I'm thinking, what a great way to examine the mind,
Yes.
right? Like, how do I feel about a certain carrot that doesn't look so
Right.
good?
Right,
Like,
right.
where's that judgmental mind coming in, right?
Yeah.
Can I transcend that? Can I
Yeah.
cook without the discriminating mind? Or who am I preparing it for? And
Right,
it's so
right.
interesting, like you said, you know, you cooked for, let's say, 200 people at the temple, right? What a different thing than now to cook just for your husband, right? And for yourself, obviously. So, and then, yeah, it's really fascinating. And
Yeah. And then another one, Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, wrote this instructions for cook. He wrote another one called Shukuhampo, which means the Dharma of taking food, how to partake. That was his second book that he wrote. And he says that, eating is practice.
oh, yeah.
Yes. So we have rules how to eat.
Share some. I'd
Yeah,
love to hear some.
so for example, there's always rice, miso soup, and pickles. That's one set. And then depending on the situation, you have like two dishes or three side dishes, and things like that. But anyway, even in school lunches, even today, we tell the kids the triangle eating. So
Okay.
you go, okay, you go first. You start off with miso soup. And when you have miso soup, you wet your chopstick in the miso soup, and then you take a sip of miso soup. That's like a palate refreshener. Okay. And chopstick, why you dip it in? Because Japanese rice is very sticky and starchy, and you don't really want to let the chopstick get sticky. So you wet it first. And then you sit, take a sip of, now you don't drink, so I tell everyone. So the way they serve soup in the Japanese restaurants in other countries, they bring the soup out and you drink it all up, but that's wrong. Okay. So you go rice, you take one sip of miso soup, and then you start one scoop of rice and side dishes. So it's triangle, right?
Right, and then
So
you cook in the mouth.
yeah. And so everything has to go low evenly. You have to eat everything evenly. So you don't eat up your soup, you don't eat up your rice, you don't eat up your side dish, but you have to go triangle, make sure everything is eaten evenly.
Nice.
That's, yeah, that's one way to eat.
So how fascinating to hear you talk about school lunches, because so you have been a teacher, right? Or you are a teacher and you have even ran a school. So you taught the kids how to eat.
No, they know it. I
Oh,
mean,
they know it, of
I
course.
don't need to teach. I don't need to teach. But then sometimes nowadays, some families' parents are not that, they don't really stress on how to eat. But in school, yes, that's how you're told, reminded. I guess that's better. Kids are reminded how to eat.
Right.
And of course, after the war, when they had the Americans given guide to Japan saying that, okay, stop eating rice, eat more bread. And the whole school lunch system changed and they went into like one plate. But now they're coming back again. They're serving kids Japanese style. So everything is a separate bowl.
Yeah. Okay. So that changed too with history.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah.
With the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So are they going back to their old ways?
Yeah. Because at one point, so when I was in school, they used to serve not rice, but bread. And then we had what you call the spork.
Right.
And then what happened was that Japanese kids couldn't hold chopsticks at one point.
Whoa. Mm-hmm.
And that was something. And then Japanese, we got, so the rice was controlled by the government, but there were too much rice in the storage because people went to eat, because we were told to eat bread. And so the government said, oh, this is not good. And they gradually changed to rice, staple rice lunches now, which is good because, you know, the wheat that comes into Japan is, it's from other countries with
it's
all
imported.
These chemicals. Yeah. Yeah. And we, our body is to make eat rice.
I just wanted to say, I mean, for me, you know, I have been studying nutrition and I feel like it's so important that we eat like our ancestors because
yes.
our guts know how, right, how our intestines know how to read basically what we're eating because they have been used for so many years.
Yes.
And when we suddenly introduce completely new things, especially toxin loaded stuff, our guts get completely confused. And then we all know that when the gut is confused, we're getting confused everywhere else too.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're not really paying enough attention to this for sure. So this is why I think it's so valuable to talk with you, especially about also these details that I had no idea. Some of the very So how do you determine like what to cook in the way, like what ingredients to choose or what to serve?
Yeah. So in Japanese cooking, like I said, the Shintoism is a nature religion. We cherish everything in the nature. So Japanese people are very, very sensitive to, and Japan is a mountainous country. 60% of the land is mountain, but we are also surrounded by ocean. So, and it's from north to south, very diverse in, what do you call the season, but we have four distinctive seasons, so we are very seasonal. We cherish the season, so we have all these things that we have to eat in certain seasons. And then everything that comes out first in the season, they say, oh yeah, this is the first fig I pick from my tree. Of course we put that on into the altar and then we eat, but we say that if you're able to eat first harvest of the season, you will live 75 days more or something. You know, there's all these different things that we believe, not like Chinese and Koreans too. So of course, I will have, like you had mentioned, this comes from the Chinese philosophy, of course, five colors of vegetables, five ways to cook, five tastes. Actually, five tastes is the Chinese way. And what makes special the Zen cooking is that we have the number six taste. Five tastes is raw, grill. No, how to cook. No, taste. No, sorry. Five tastes, sweet, sour,
right,
bitter, spicy, hot, and one more. What is this?
What did we say?
Let's see. Okay.
Sour?
Bitter.
Sour?
Okay. Bitter. Bitter, sour, sweet, spicy, hot, and salty.
Salty, yeah.
Okay. But now people, they began to say that spicy hot is not, it's not a taste. It's from your senses. So they took that out and they put umami in it. Okay.
Which one?
But umami, the spicy, the chili hot, spicy this? Hot is not a taste with your taste buds.
Mm-hmm.
So that has changed to umami. Umami is like when you make like bone broth or when you cook the vegetables, you know, those the flavor that comes out from the ingredients, that's called umami. And so that became like a, what do you call, worldwide known word in the gastronomy.
Oh, but, really? Interesting.
Yeah, umami. Now, Shojin Ryori, the Zen vegetarian cuisine, has number six taste, which is called the subtleness, subtle. Now, subtle is not, doesn't mean that now it's less salty. It means that to enhance the natural flavor. So you don't, you know, so in Zen cooking, if you have a, like a one big pot simmered, you should be, if there's five vegetables in it, you should be able to taste all five different tastes, but as a whole is another level of taste.
Yes.
So each ingredient need to have its own flavor. We need to be able to taste the subtleness of the natural flavor. So it's very like, you know, spices and herbs are mostly come from the warm places, right? So in Japan, Japanese food is very subtle in general, but still in Zen cooking, we have to make sure we should be able to taste the original flavor instead of just putting, you know, dressing on everything, marinating everything, you know. So that's the big difference. And so there's five ways to cook. That's raw, simmer, fry, deep fry, and steam. And five colors, green, yellow, red, white, black. So if you incorporate all this in one meal, you will have a well-balanced meal.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny because for me, how I taught in that, what you're describing right now with the five elements and the five,
right,
is what we have called Taoistic cooking.
Mm-hmm,
but I guess we could call it Zen cooking. Like, and then I don't know about you, but we have been taught, and I've been doing that a lot, adding the ingredients according to the cycle.
Yes.
Okay.
That's where it comes from, yeah.
Right. So for the listeners, you know, the cycle would be, let's say, right now we're in fall, right? So that would be the element of metal.
Exactly.
It has to do with the spiciness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to actually nurture our lungs, right? In that time.
Yeah.
So we want to nurture the lungs. And so how do we do that? We want to either start with spicy. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here. That's just how I've been taught. And then, you know, go through the cycle, which means from there you go winter, which you add some salt. And then you go to the spring, which is more the sour taste. You add something a little sour, something that's related to the spring. And then you go to the summer, right? Which is more the bitter taste of fire.
Yes, yeah.
And then you end up back in the metal.
Yeah.
And so every time you adding an ingredient, you kind of have to get through the cycle again.
So
right?
that's the basis that because a lot of things, you know, came from China. So the Chinese philosophy has influenced into that. And so, but another thing is that we try to, like I said, we're very nature bound you know, people. And so we try to do that with the dishes too. Not like when it's Christmas, you use a Christmas decorated plate. But for example, summer, we use a lot of glass dishes.
Oh, why?
Yeah, because it looks cool.
Okay.
Keep cool. Because Japan is very, we incorporate the nature onto our table.
To cooling down the heat, you're using a glass plate.
Yeah.
Oh, so you have different plates each season?
We don't really have different plates each season, but we have a tendency to use like a bamboo and glass dishes in summer. We never serve it in winter.
Right.
And then
And
we, you, yeah, and you know, clay pots in winter. And of course, some decorative dishes in certain seasons. Yeah, we have that too. But we're very, so I guess we can say that we don't really have a seasonal dishes, but we have rules that you should not use this in this season, the other way around. Yeah.
Is it because of the influence of the food on the body?
I think it comes from our, because we cherish the four seasons a lot, and the seasons are so distinct, you know. And then, of course, Japan is pretty, it is moderate, but still we're in the monsoon area, and summer can be very humid and hot. So by looking, you feel cool. Or by serving even the same noodle in summer, we will put some cold water, and then we'll put the noodle in and make it into like it's kind of flowing, you know.
Exactly.
So we do play a lot, are very playful. Yeah. And then we also use on our plates, like in, I think in Western cooking, you don't put things on the plate that's not edible, right? Everything should be edible in Western cooking.
Yeah,
but
pretty much.
Yeah, in Japan there are a lot of things we just put it for decoration. So I have to make sure, when I take my husband, he likes to be have eat clean. So I said, don't eat that, that's not edible, you know. And he goes, well, why do you put it on then? Because it's for decoration.
It's not all just practical. It's
no,
because we're
yeah.
also eating with the eye, right?
Yes. That's one more thing. Yeah, in Japanese, we said Japanese eat with our eyes. Yes.
Well,
and that's very important.
It is. It's because for me, I mean, and I would even say we're eating with the nose, right? Because
yeah,
when
yeah,
we
yeah.
see something and smell something, our gut already knows
yes.
what enzymes to put
yeah
out, which is
exactly
fascinating. So if we
mm-hmm.
really do that, then we already prepare our digestive tract to actually be more successful digesting. And I think especially in the age we're living now, we have so many problems with the digestive tract. And it really comes from our habits of not eating. Like how we eat, as you said, and then also what we eat. But I think it's really, really both. I mean, I've met a lot of folks who might eat healthy, looks like it, but they eat so fast and so unconscious that the body's overwhelmed with digesting
Oh,
it.
yeah. But that's another thing. See, I eat really quickly. My husband too, but he says, I'm the first one that eats faster than him. But we Japanese, we so the to the dinner meal time is not a chatting time in temple. You have to make no sound. Even things crunchy, you don't make sound. That's really being mindful to focus on what you do. So as a consequence, we're eating pretty fast because there's no chatting. My father would always used to say, you know, keep your mouth shut and eat. So we eat pretty fast.
It's funny, I have a little story about that. You know, when I used to go to Sessions, and even when I lived with my master for a year in his Zen monastery in Germany, it was the eating times, obviously, right, are quiet because you're in the middle of a silent retreat, you know. So everybody shows up, takes a plate, takes a seat, and the food is on the table. It's everything by the minute. And and so we would sit down and eat. And, you know, I never really ate that much, so it never bothered me. But basically, when the last person is done eating, means when the last person makes noises with their utensils, we didn't have chopsticks, you know, but we actually had fork and knife. So you hear when somebody eats. And in a big eating hall, when the last person doesn't make noise anymore, you know, the master gets up and leaves. So the problem was always who will be last. Nobody wanted to be last. So people would eat really fast, especially some of my friends, you know, who were young, you know, friends of mine who were hungry, you know, they basically ate really, really fast. So it's really, I had just had to think about that. And then as a contrast, right, from the Zen, when I used to do mindfulness retreats, it's the opposite. You literally would sit for an hour all together.
Oh, really?
Still silently. Silently. Yeah, I know. Bizarre. And each bite you would chew and savor and smell, and just, we would literally sit all together there for at least like 50 minutes and just chew and be with the food. It's just these contrasts.
Wow.
Both, right? Both has to do with a certain practice.
Yeah. So yeah, that's really different. In Zen monastery too, they have very short time for
exactly
meal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But again, I think just as long as we're really with the food and aware,
yes,
and not,
yes,
necessarily, I mean, yeah, even just, you know, greeting the food, sitting down and see what we
yeah
put on the plate,
yeah exactly yeah uh-huh.
would be so wonderful, just to
mm-hmm.
really take in the flavors, the colors, and of course then we would also cook differently if we actually
mm-hmm.
would look at it,
yeah mm-hmm.
Right, and
and
not just,
yeah. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and then there's, you know, all the rituals that you have to do before eating, after eating. So that's kind of interesting too. But yeah,
like
in Japan,
do you want to share
mm-hmm.
a little bit what rituals?
So right after, we, of course, the traditional Japanese food, Japanese meal, you're not supposed to drink any liquid when you're eating, because you have miso soup. And of course, in Zen temples, the tea is not served while you're eating. But afterwards, what you do, will pour some hot water, not tea, hot water into the rice bowl.
Correct.
So the rice bowl is called Buddha's head,
mm-hmm.
the biggest bowl. And so we will never put our lips to it. And then, so what we do is, after your meal is done, you'll be served some hot water into the rice bowl, and you're supposed to leave one piece of pickles, and using the pickles, you take off all the starchy, you know, the rice, leftover rice from the bowl. And because you don't put lips to the rice bowl, it's so important, you pour that hot water into the next bowl, which is the soup bowl. And then you wash it again. And then you put that water into the other bowl. And then you wash everything at the end, the smallest bowl, you drink it up. So you clean all your bowls. And then at the end, you drink that. So you clean your mouth too.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, I've experienced that in certain sessions myself. It's a very beautiful tradition.
Yes, yes.
To
it
actually
is,
partake.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then so the rice, like I said, even nowadays, when you go to people's homes in Japan, rice bowl is only for the rice. You never put other stuff. So remember that. When I came to California, you know, we have every year, because Jay is Hindu, we have chanting party every year, right? And then we try not to use any paper goods, so we will use whatever we have. And so after meal, Jay took out my rice bowl, started putting ice cream, and I said,
oh,
you know, Jay, that's my rice bowl. I said, I don't think you should put ice cream in the rice bowl. And he goes, why? And I said, because it's rice bowl. And he said, yeah, it's just a bowl. So I said, no, it's rice bowl. And then at that point, I didn't really remember why we don't serve other food in the rice bowl. And then so I just kind of let it go. And the following year, I said, okay, you cannot serve ice cream in my rice bowl, because that's Buddha's head, and only rice can go in there. So that was really, you know, that's where I really had to reteach myself, remember that, yeah, that's that's the part that I had forgotten, you know.
So there's a real process, a real reason behind it. You just did it because you were told.
Exactly.
It's so funny.
So from the following year, I said, I'm going to buy paper cups just for the ice cream.
Right. Oh, yeah, exactly. There's so much to chat about when it comes to food. And I'm so excited to share this with you because I feel so very similar about cooking and eating. It's just really a practice in the way of living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I hear a lot from people, and I think it's their reality, how they perceive it, is like, I don't have time to cook, right?
Yeah.
I don't have time to sit down and eat. What do you have to say here?
But this is, well, it's kind of pitiful when I hear that, because like you take time to go to bed, and food is not just about eating, not just about feeding your body, but, you know, it feeds our soul, and it's a means of communication. And you can make, I think life will be much more interesting and much more valuable. And as you grow older, you appreciate, you know, how you approach the food, because when you're young, whatever you eat is okay, but after 50s and 60s, your body knew that the food that we've been eating is what you get now. And it's just, if you say you don't have time to eat but you still feel hungry, then, you know, you could at least be mindful, and you can eat whatever you, that's what I told my students. Yeah, you can go to a convenience store and buy like a bento or something, but take time and eat with your family at least. Share the same food, not eating things by yourself. If you don't have time, you can buy things, but make sure you sit and, you know, at least enjoy that time to eat and share, because it will feed our soul at least. And that's really important. I think that's really important. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like it's again, like with so many things, it's a question of priority, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Even if we do have a busy life, you know, not every cooking and not everything takes a lot of time. It's a priority. Am I gonna put a half an hour away where I can cook and perhaps even start to find joy in cooking, right? Yeah. In the way of slowing things down and really being with this activity of cutting up things, making it transform into this meal. I mean, it's really it's an amazing process. Like, and some of us who are blessed with gardens, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of my favorite things is even after a busy and long day, coming home and strolling my garden and see what I can eat from out there. And or even if it's just herbs in the winter, but something that's just been so alive.
Exactly. Adding
food. Yeah. It's such a joy. And it makes me feel so connected to myself and the world, really, when I do that. I think a lot of our problems we're having also is the disconnect. And, and the manufactured food is really part of that disconnect, that we're not even knowing anymore which season we're in, you know, what's growing on the land, and how to share food, as you said, is another important part. Yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of our health, and we forget that.
I know.
We're not just, you know, we're not just like taking in calories here.
Exactly, I know. Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And no matter where you are there, I'm sure you can feel that the connectedness, you know, to the nature. I think that's really important. The food will connect you.
Yeah. It will, if we eat seasonal, right?
Yeah.
Local, yeah. Even yes. More so.
Yeah.
So what do you, for you, is it really important the quality of the ingredients, or you think it's more important how we cook it, or it's more important how we eat it, or is it all important?
Yes, in Zen cooking, we do say uchimotsu zentai, which means to eat as a whole. So in order to do that, yes, if it's, I try to pick organic things, and if it's organic and if not, I don't have to serve to guests. I will eat the whole thing, instead of peeling things. So in that way, yeah, organic is, we try to go organic, yes. And try not to waste, eat whatever is available. But of course, some people are just so into organic that it kind of goes beyond, it's just too much. Then I will, I'm kind of loose, but if there's organic things, I will use them and I will try to eat the whole, not wasting the skin and everything, yeah. I think that's important. It's just that, I'm not a chemist. I don't really know how much chemicals are in it, but that's the only way that I can judge. So I'll buy things that says organic. And when I see, for example, like in the local markets here, when you go, like organic ginger roots are like this small, but when you go to the other supermarkets, it's like huge. Then I go, oh no, why is this so huge? What are they giving this?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah. So comparing things, yeah. So organic things are tend to run kind of small, but yeah, I think it's important in the long run.
Right. Yeah. And for me, it's also like that whole idea these days we can buy everything all the time, right? And I'm really trying, especially because I'm blessed to have a garden. I know what's seasonal, and I grew up as a child always eating out of a, basically organic garden. So I know what's seasonal, and I'm trying to eat
Yes,
seasonal. And
that's
I do believe that's really the important part because, again, just as we talked with the five elements, right? It's all about the balance that we can help our bodies to achieve with eating and with the right foods. So if we eat foods in the winter that are actually better for the summer, like cucumbers and watermelons,
Yeah, we don't need that in winter.
exactly, because we will cool our body down, right? It's just the same way that we don't eat bone broth in the winter and the summer because we get way too hot. So starting to use those, if we do eat seasonal, we don't even have to understand the whole influences of the foods because we're already getting from nature the balancing act. Like in the summer when it's hot, the cooling down, in the winter when it's cold, the warming up from the inside. And that's why I feel really that seasonal eating and also the way we cook in the winter is different than in the summer. It has a real deep purpose here.
Another thing for Japanese is that, as you know, fermented food is very important in Japanese diet, and especially in the Zen cooking, the all the seasoning that we use, mostly everything, actually everything is fermented. So the seasoning will be like, well, not salt, but anyway, soy sauce, mirin, sweet rice wine, sake, miso, they are all fermented ingredients that we use.
Why do you think that is? Is it because of the gut health or because of
Yes, it's
preservation or
both. It's well, it really started because in the Japanese environment, it's really humid and things ferment. That was a natural for the Japanese people to use fermented food. But yes, that's really right now. We eat it for the gut health, and I think it really helps, especially the koji. Koji is a inoculated rice spores that makes miso shoyu, all the Japanese ingredients. They are really goes directly into the gut, and yes, we I'm sure that's why we Japanese have the one of the we live long, right? The longevity, that's a key word for the longevity, and we eat it's our diet is plant-based. And yeah, it's and then of course I like it because the process of fermentation is there's a waiting period, and that's really important.
How so?
So, because everything right now, because people are just saying that, okay, fast is good, but you know, you start to ferment things and then you can see the it changes in the long process and it becomes better, and it, you know, the nutrients are really condensed, and there's a seasonal thing. It kind of, we usually start fermenting in winter, and then over summer it we let it sit, and next winter we open it up and eat. That's how the Japanese, because in Japan the rice is only cultivated once a year.
Right.
That's why that's our cycle. Once a year cycle. You know.
And so then, you let things process over the year, and then you can cook it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then waiting period, you know, you don't, you can't, of course, if you, people will start putting additives and preservatives so that you make it, you make the waiting period very short, but in a way, you know, it, the waiting is really nice process. It's very mindful. You wait for things, you know, to happen. And I think it's a good way to slow down this busy, busy, you know, world.
And also the mind who wants the things right now, like having that stamina of waiting and then appreciating when something is ripe. Yeah.
But for me, you know, just living in off the grid in California, that's really, we don't have things and we don't go to the market every day. So that really kind of slows you. You have to forcefully slow yourself down, which is good. You know, you don't really need things right away. And we, that's really good. So that means you keep your mind open. Okay, I don't need this now. I'll do something else now. You know, makes it more, make your life creative. Yeah, I really like that. Because we don't just go to the store to buy like a bag of sugar. But oh, never mind. We'll go next week. You know, well, we can do something else in the meantime. I really like that. Living.
You have more time for the essential things, right?
Exactly.
For sure. Yeah, how fascinating. There's so much practice opportunity in cooking and eating.
Yes.
So I also, you know, I do hear from a lot of people, and even for me, who I love to cook and I normally don't get bored, but sometimes I'm like, oh, darn it. What am I going to cook tonight? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the burnout, right? When, and I hear this from a lot of folks. It's like, I've been cooking for centuries, basically, and I'm just running out of steam and out of, you know, love for it. What would you suggest? Do you have an idea how to kind of overcome that?
Well, I think, yeah, we all have that. I think what helps me is that to keep, different types of like marinades, so I have different types of fermented sauces that I keep on hand, and then, you know, all you do is steam or fry some vegetables and use different, so it's not, if it's not from the store, of course you can buy all these seasonings, but anything, sauces and what do you call, any kind of paste, I think they really help. So learn how to utilize what you have. You don't have to make it. I don't make everything from scratch.
Right.
We don't really do that. But, you know, so I said, some people will actually come to me and say, I can't cook every day. I don't have time, or I don't really like it. And for those people, I do recommend keeping some basic seasoning, fermented seasoning that's already blended. You know, and of course you can find anything online that will keep, and then use them. Yeah.
So experimenting with different seasonings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Switching things up a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I think if you continue to do that, you know that what's your favorite taste. Yeah.
Right.
And like yesterday when I had some cooking, you know, you have this basic salt, soy sauce or something. And then if you add a little bit of sesame oil, it turns into maybe it turns into Chinese taste, or if you add oyster sauce, it will turn into a different taste. You know, those kind of things, it will come to you gradually, but you have to start somewhere. So, yeah, but
yeah,
it's good to have, yeah, some seasoning in hand. Yeah,
I'm just thinking, you know, it's also the idea, I think, for most of us that we need such a huge different kinds of varieties at all times,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
And I think often for me, it's not even, I get caught up there as well. It's like, oh, I only cook like the same few dishes at all times. Can I switch this up? And yes, that's sometimes fun. Right, ask other people, hey, what are you cooking? However, I find more satisfaction in cooking and eating if I actually put purpose into it. You know, even if it's the same old dish that I'm making, but like really putting purpose into that and say, oh, perhaps what else do I have in my garden or what else do I have in my fridge? Can I add it? Can I create something a little bit different? And it doesn't always need to be this grandiose, you know,
Yeah.
something, but really the simple but purposefully cooked meal can be sometimes just the best thing ever.
Yeah, and of course, if you don't really want to cook, sometimes I don't mind going out to eat too. And then you realize that, okay, I should have cooked, you know.
Yeah, that happens to me a lot too. I'm like, oh, this sounds really good to go out to eat. But then,
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So, yeah, you don't really have to feel so stressful, you know. And then what you do is what I do, especially at home, because we don't go to the market so often. And if we do, especially when I buy Japanese things from San Francisco, I taught myself how to preserve each vegetable as it is. For example, you know, some vegetables or mushrooms, you have to unpack everything, and you might want to dry it, or you might want to repack it, and you know, do some least preparation and keep it in your refrigerator instead of just shoving everything into the refrigerator right from the market. That I think that helps too.
Oh, so you're already preparing it while you put it in the fridge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
For example, mushrooms, not in locally you can buy bulk. So even at bulk to mushroom, you have to know the vegetables. If it's root vegetables, try to store it. You wrap them in a newspaper or like a paper towel, and then you put it in a plastic bag because they create moisture. And then, like mushrooms, they're gonna mold, or they become really mushy. So what you do is you let it out, you break it apart, and you air them for about a day, and then you put it away. Then they will keep for long. You know that
oh,
type
really?
of
even fresh mushrooms.
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking about the fresh mushrooms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you let them sit. Not you don't even put them in the fridge right away.
No, you don't. Mushrooms, you don't have to put it in the refrigerator.
I see.
But you have to take it out from the plastic bag because they have moist, very moisture in them.
Oh yeah.
And then they're gonna start to, you know, turn gooey. So what you do is you kind of semi dry them and then you put it in a plastic bag. Yeah.
I see.
Or dry them completely. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I normally put them in a paper bag. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is really, with everything, the storing, the buying, the what food, prep it, do you ever pay attention how you cut things, like what shapes?
Yes, that's really important in Japanese cooking.
Right.
Yes. Depending on how you cut it, how it cooks, it's on how the cooking process changes too.
And I feel like even the taste changes.
Yes, changes. Because yeah, the texture changes too. So the way it absorbs the flavor changes too. Yeah,
can you
cutting
give
is
an
very
example?
Important. For example, some, let's see. Oh yeah, like cabbage. If you're going to saute a cabbage, it's good if you tear it with your hand. instead of sharp edges on the vegetables, tearing with your hand makes it more flavorful. It absorbs more flavor. And of course, a lot of Japanese, like daikon radish, the bottom is very, the root part is very, very spicy hot, but the top is sweeter. So you use, you know, you kind of change where to use. And that too, it's very fibery. So you don't really want to, you want to cut it not along the fiber, but against the fiber if you want to cook it quicker. Yeah. Yeah, we have different ways to cut different, different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even carrots, they can be cut in many different ways. And they do taste different.
Yeah.
You count little rounds, or if you count little, more long pieces.
So, in Japanese, we have different ways to prepare different vegetables. Yeah.
And, you know, just as we said, you know, when we get bored with cooking, perhaps try switching up how you cut something, right? Yeah. Or, you know, how you add it. Like, again, as we talked with the five elements, I actually taught last year, I think it was, or 2 years ago already, I taught a Taoistic cooking class here in town about how to add the element, you know, the different foods and how to add them to make a real Taoist.
And then and then the order of adding spice makes a difference
too. Exactly how to which order you add it and all of that, which organ you're nurturing, and I mean there's so much, really. Sunoko, we are pretty much almost at the end here. I'm curious, do you have last things, like how do people get in touch with you, what else do you like to share with the audience?
If you would just type in my name, I think I have a home page. It's called One Plate Zen. Why it's one plate? Because when I went to California, my husband's, he only had huge plate, and I cooked Zen meal, and I had to put everything on one plate. So I decided to name my my home page One Plate Zen.
Instead of all the bowls, right?
Yeah. Yes. And then now, of course, I have all these Japanese dishes that I use. But yes, so if you type in One Plate, then I think my homepage will appear. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram sharing my husband's everyday brunch, if you're curious. Yes.
Okay, yes, One Plate Zen.
Yeah.
And or N-O-N-A-O-K-O. O-L-L-E-R.
Yes.
Noko Moller. Mm-hmm. And you're teaching any cooking classes coming up?
Yes. I'm going to go to two islands. I have I have workshops to do. But also locally or even over Zoom, I do on demand classes now.
So people can get in touch with you and say, hey, can you teach us? Yeah. Oh, how great.
So recently I had sushi rolling class and a fermentation class. You can contact me, and if you're interested in Japanese cooking, please do so. Well, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, so I'm roasting turkeys here.
Right. Yep. We do the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this show you will hear after Thanksgiving. And I hope you had a good meal there. So thank you so much, Noko. You were listening to Mindful Mud. What a wonderful conversation, Noko. Thank you again. Wishing you all well.
This has been a K-Mud podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.